Lecture 6, Deeds of Loving Kindness.
We're now moving on to the third of Shimon the Righteous's tripod of things that the world stands on or is sustained by, and that is Gemilut Chasadim, or Deeds of Loving Kindness. I'll be referring to the Hebrew Gemilut Chasadim throughout the lecture. Of course, we see this within the Torah itself as commandments, as well as the deeds of loving kindness, say, that Abraham does. In Genesis 18, the chapter right after he's been circumcised, we find Abraham sitting out in front of his tent in the heat of the day, scanning the horizon, looking for wayfarers in order to bring them in and show them hospitality. So this idea of Gemilut Chasadim as it originates in the Bible can be learned both from the deeds of the patriarchs as well as from the mitzvot, or from the commandments. So now let's take a look at some of the commandments. One of the most famous chapters in the Torah is Leviticus 19, and some of the most beautiful ethical maxims are found within that chapter. And what's interesting to scholars is that that chapter brings together ethical commandments and ritual commandments. So for instance, you have the mitzvah of you shall not insult the deaf nor place a stumbling block before the blind in that chapter. Now, why shouldn't you insult the deaf? They can't hear the insult, right? And what kind of creep would put a stumbling block before a blind person? So the rabbis then unpack that, and so, you know, it's not about insulting the deaf person, the damage that you're doing to the deaf person. It's about the damage that you're doing to yourself in the process of insulting the deaf person and the people that can hear you. And it's very interesting how the rabbis understand you shall not place a stumbling block before the blind, that you're not supposed to give somebody bad advice. Right? The rabbis can't imagine that somebody would take a milk crate outside, place it outside of a blind person's apartment door so they would trip on it when they come out. Right? That's unimaginable. But if you know someone has a weakness for chocolate cake and they're trying to diet, then what you don't want to do is put a piece of chocolate cake in front of him after dinner and say, oh, I know you're dieting, you don't have to have that, but you know, it's on the table. Right? You don't want to put a stumbling block before the blind in a metaphorical sense. Also in that chapter, we've got commandments like, do not turn to idols or make molten gods for yourselves. So first we had ethics, now we've got something to do with ritual. Also in that same chapter, you shall not round off the side growth of your head or destroy the side growth of your beard. That explains why some ultra-Orthodox Jews, most ultra-Orthodox Jews, male Jews, I should specify, have the side curls or the dreadlocks because they're not supposed to shave. In the modern Orthodox world and in the conservative world, you notice that the men have sideburns even when it's not particularly fashionable to have sideburns. But it's from this particular law of leaving the sides. And the way to say sides in Hebrew is peyot. And that's what you call the side curls on the ultra-Orthodox Jews. They use the Ashkenazi pronunciation, the European or the Yiddish, European Jewish or Yiddish pronunciation, payas. They've got the payas, the side curls. Does that make you an unholy person to have those side curls? No, of course not. If we use a kind of sociology of religion posture toward understanding that, it seems as though at that time the people that shaved the corners of their heads were also involved in other kinds of activities, whether they were idolatrous activities or cultic prostitution, that the authors of that text wanted the members of their community to keep away from. It's parallel, I think, in some way, to what goes on in today's culture with tattoos and body piercing. Does having a tattoo or does having a body piercing make you a bad person? No, of course not. But it might influence the crowd you keep. And if that crowd that you keep does things that are perceived by your parents, right, as immoral, then you might want to prevent your children or you might want to discourage your children from engaging in body piercing and tattooing to keep them in a different crowd whose activities you approve of. Now, the prophetic books offer a kind of critique of the priesthood. Remember, in Leviticus 19, we saw ethics and ritual together. But what begins to happen in the 8th century BCE, before the Common Era, is that the prophets see that the priests themselves, as well as many of the people in the community, are engaging in these animal sacrifices in order to effect atonement, while not changing their evil ways, while not striving after moral purity. So there's this prophetic critique of the priesthood in many of the minor prophets. For instance, in the book of Amos, they promote the idea, they don't want to diminish the idea of the cult, but they want to promote the idea that moral purity is an absolutely essential ingredient in order to finally effect that atonement. And in Micah, the book of Micah, he sums it up very nicely by saying, "He has told you, O man, what is good and what the Lord requires of you, only to do justice, to love goodness, and to walk modestly with your God." Right? That's the prophetic motto, those three ideas. And the word chesed, mercy, loving mercy, is in that sequence of things that God has commanded us to do. One of the last books of the Tanakh demonstrates this, I think, in a lovely way. One of the last texts to actually be written that was included in the Tanakh is the book of Esther. The story commemorates the triumph of the Jews against those who plotted to destroy them. In outlining how the day should be celebrated in the future, the text enjoins giving presents to the poor. Why? The story of the salvation of the Jews in Shushan, the story of Esther, doesn't have anything about giving presents to the poor. But as long as you're going to have a holiday, as long as you're going to have a party, remember the poor, give presents to the poor. It's a beautiful illustration of how adventitious but important this idea of giving presents to the poor is. It's adventitious to the story, but it's absolutely central to the ideology of the biblical authors themselves. And it becomes even more important as we move into the rabbinic period. So let's take a look at the rabbinic promotion of the idea of Gemilut Chasadim. Now, as I said before, in the realm of Agadah, that area of Jewish literature that doesn't specifically deal with the law, with halakha, the rabbis felt very free to exaggerate and be hyperbolic and be very colorful and dramatic. So amongst the things that they say about Gemilut Chasadim is that atonement comes through Gemilut Chasadim, right? Not through animal sacrifice anymore because the temple has been destroyed. So one way now to effect atonement is through deeds of loving kindness, Gemilut Chasadim. Even the Messiah comes through Gemilut Chasadim. The Torah, one of the statements by Rabbi Simlai, is that the Torah is all about Gemilut Chasadim from the beginning to the end. And what's his proof text for this? It's very nice. Rabbi Simlai taught, the Torah begins with Gemilut Chasadim and ends with Gemilut Chasadim, as it is written, the Lord God made for Adam and his wife garments of skin and clothed them. In the Garden of Eden, when Adam and Eve realize that they're naked after they've eaten from the tree, what does God do? God clothes the naked. So as God clothes the naked, so too should we clothe the naked in imitation of God. And then at the very end of the Torah, it says in Deuteronomy, and God buried Moses in the valley of the land of Moab. And just like God buries the dead, so too, in an imitation of God, should we bury the dead. Another statement in the Talmud is that Gemilut Chasadim is better than giving tzedakah. That word tzedakah, the root is righteousness. It's frequently translated into English as charity, but charity is something nice that you do for someone else. It comes from the heart. It's not an academic link, but somebody suggested that charity and cardiology, right, are related. I don't think it's true, but the idea of charity, it's coming from the heart, it's a nice thing you do. Tzedakah in the Jewish tradition, with that root of righteousness, it's the right thing to do. It's not just a nice thing to do, it's the right thing to do, and indeed, it's a commandment. According to Jewish law, you need to give at a minimum 10% of gross income, not net, but gross income, right? So perhaps this was in the day before 30% tax brackets, but nevertheless, the law is you're supposed to give at least 10%. So why is Gemilut Chasadim better than Tzedakah? We've got three reasons. Tzedakah is only through money, while Gemilut Chasadim can be done through one's physical efforts, right? You can do something nice for somebody. Tzedakah is only for the poor. You don't give tzedakah to the rich. But Gemilut Chasadim can also be for the wealthy, right? Very often the wealthy, right, they might have money, but they need other things to help enhance their life. And finally, tzedakah is for the living, while Gemilut Chasadim can also be for the dead, as we saw with the example of God bearing Moses at the very end of the Torah. When we talked about one of the other pillars of Shimon the Righteous's tripod, Talmud Torah, I talked about how attractive and how all-consuming for some rabbis Talmud Torah is. But it needs to be balanced with Gemilut Chasadim, with deeds of loving kindness. You can't study all the time. And so the rabbis very frequently would try to figure out, well, which one is more important? So we have a debate in the Talmud about which is greater, study or deeds. Rabbi Tarfon answered, deeds. Rabbi Akiva, who is really one of the giants in rabbinic Judaism, answered, study. The sages responded by saying, study is greater. It's very tough to disagree with Rabbi Akiva. Study is greater. Why? Since study leads to deeds. Study leads to deeds. Once you study Talmud Torah, you know why it's important to do this act of Gemilut Chasadim, these acts of loving kindness. Now, coming from Rabbi Akiva, it's somewhat of a surprising statement because there's another argument that the rabbis have about what is the greatest principle of the Torah. And one rabbi, Ben Azai, says the greatest principle in the Torah is that human beings were created in the divine image. And as a result of that, everyone should be accorded dignity and respect. Rabbi Akiva, echoing Jesus, right, says, no, the most important principle in the Torah is you shall show love to your neighbor as yourself. It's about love. So love is a stronger emotion than dignity and respect, and it's harder to fulfill. But Rabbi Akiva says you shall love your neighbor, right, the one next door to you. And in the biblical period, or even in the rabbinic period, very often the one living next door to you was like you in many ways. In other words, was Jewish or was part of the same community, part of the same society. What Ben Azai is saying is that, no, we need to show dignity and respect, which might not be as hard. I think it's still very difficult, but it might not be as hard as loving somebody, but we need to extend the circle of that dignity and respect to everyone in the world because everyone is created in the divine image. So Rabbi Akiva says that loving your neighbor as yourself, showing love toward your neighbor as yourself, is the greatest principle of the Torah. But he says that what's more important? Study. Right? Talmud Torah. Study is more important than deeds. So you really have the sense that he believed how the rabbis understood what he said was that study leads to deeds. Right? Study leads to showing. The more we study, the more reason we'll have to spread that love out beyond ourselves to the rest of the members of the community. Another rabbinic statement found in the Mishnah, and just for a little review, the Mishnah is that legal codex redacted around the year 220 by Judah the Patriarch, or Judah the Prince, the first literary production of rabbinic Judaism. It is almost all halakha. It says the following, these are the things that a person enjoys the fruits of, or the interest of, in this world, while the principle remains for the world to come. Honoring one's mother and father, Gemilut Chasadim, and being a peacemaker. But Talmud Torah is equal to them all. So if you imagine scales, right, which is how I think what that image is of being equal to them all, you've got honoring your mother and father, Gemilut Chasadim, being a peacemaker, and then Talmud Torah balances them all out. And I think also the idea here is that the reason why Talmud Torah can balance them all out and should balance them all out is because the more you study Torah, the more you should be involved in doing those things on the other end of the scale. And again, we've got this statement that I mentioned earlier. He who engages exclusively in Talmud Torah is as one who has no God. Which really lets you know that there were people who engaged exclusively in Talmud Torah. And so the rabbis had to create these very sharp, pithy aphorisms in order to zing them into getting out of the academy, getting out of the study hall, and participating in the life of the community. Within the rabbinic elite, there was frequent concern with the proper balance between studying and participation in family and communal affairs. That tension was then codified by some of the medieval legalists like Maimonides, who we've mentioned before, and we'll have a whole session on Maimonides in the future. But Maimonides wrote his legal code, the Mishneh Torah, in 1180, and he has a few things to say about Gemilut Chasadim. The rabbis distinguished between mitzvot that the rabbis themselves enacted and mitzvot that come from the Torah. Mitzvot, commandments that come from the Torah, they have divine authority. Mitzvot that the rabbis themselves enacted, you still have to follow them, but they're of a lower level of authority. What Maimonides does is he explains that the following mitzvot were formulated by the rabbis of the Talmud, but they derive their authority from the Torah itself. This is now Maimonides. It's a positive commandment, meaning you have to do it, from what they, the rabbis, said, to visit the sick, to comfort mourners, to attend to the diseased, and all the to attend to the deceased and all the details surrounding the funeral, to tend the bride to make sure that she has a proper dowry and trousseau, and to escort guests in and out. These are gemilut chasadim, which are done by the person and have no limits. Even though all of these commandments are spelled out by the rabbis in the Talmud, they all fall under the general rule of loving your neighbor as yourself. Right? That's the end of Maimonides. So he takes that verse in Leviticus 19, the verse that we started out with, love your neighbor as yourself, or show love to your neighbor as yourself is probably a better translation of that. And the rabbis unpack it into all kinds of ethical actions that, on the one hand, they're deeds of loving kindness, but according to Maimonides, they're actually commandments as well. So it's not as though you're doing it out of the voluntary love of your heart. You're commanded to do all those things. So there's a relationship between doing nice things and doing what you're commanded to do. That's how Gemilut Chasadim looks in the Middle Ages in terms of its codification by Maimonides. I thought that we would now jump several hundred years and talk a little bit about how Gemilut Chasadim worked itself out in this country, in the United States, even before it was called the United States. Perhaps you remember from your colonial history that Peter Stuyvesant was the governor of New Amsterdam. Well, it turns out that there was a group of Jews that left Recife, Brazil in 1654, and they arrived in the harbor of New Amsterdam, and Peter Stuyvesant didn't want to let them disembark. And so he sent a telegram, probably not a telegram, but he sent word to the Dutch West Indies Company, and through some Jewish influence in Amsterdam, the Dutch West Indies Company said, no, you've got to let these 23 Jews from Recife, Brazil, disembark. Remember, this is 1654. We're actually, this year, 2004, we're celebrating the 350th anniversary of the organized Jewish presence in this country. So the condition was Peter Stuyvesant wouldn't let these 23 Jews disembark from the boat unless they agreed to take care of their own. In other words, they couldn't become wards or charges of the state. They couldn't be on the dole. They couldn't be collecting unemployment. So this long tradition from the biblical period, rabbinic and medieval, of community support and making sure that people have a subsidized level of living, was one of the conditions for residency in the New World. So it starts that early. Now let's fast forward a couple of hundred years, 200 years. The Jews, the largest number of Jews to emigrate to the United States were from Eastern Europe. They were dirt poor. Between 1881 and 1914, 1917, the years around World War I, 2.25 million Jews from Eastern Europe emigrated, joining a native population of about 250,000. So in those, from 1880 to 1917, the American Jewish population went from 250,000 to 2.5 million. Right, an incredible explosion of Jews in the new country, in the United States now. Dirt poor from what we call the Pale of Settlement, Russia, Poland, Ukraine, White Russia, Yellow Russia, came to these shores. And the 250,000 Jews, even though they tended to be German Jews and felt a little embarrassed. The German Jews were of high culture, and they were a little embarrassed by these greenhorns who were coming in who didn't speak the language. They didn't even speak German. They spoke this kind of low-level German called Yiddish, this combination of Hebrew, mostly German, but a few Hebrew words thrown in. And they didn't dress nicely, and they weren't cultured, and they weren't polished, and they didn't know who Heinrich Heine was. But nevertheless, they felt a certain responsibility to help acculturate these Jews by providing seed money. So what we have as the Eastern European Jews come into this country is that the German Jews, who were relative old-timers in America, they established clinics, hospitals, old-age homes, orphanages, vocational schools, settlement houses, and free loan societies. Now, that long list of things that the German Jews helped to establish is common to many other ethnic groups in the United States, except for free loan societies. That's something that is actually distinctive and unique to the Jewish community. Free loan societies, beginning in the 1880s, were an extension of that there's a biblical prohibition against charging interest in loans to other Jews. Let me read you that one of those commandments from the book of Exodus. If you lend money to my people, to the poor among you, do not act toward them as a creditor, exact no interest from them. So the idea of free loans is already found in the biblical period. Notice, I'm sure people have the image that Jews were money lenders throughout history. This, of course, is true. The church positioned the Jews, that canon law prohibited Christians from loaning money at interest, using the same law in the Bible. So the only people that could then loan money to Christians were the Jews, because the Jewish prohibition was only about loaning money to other Jews with interest. And so you need credit in an economy. So it was important for many European countries throughout history to have a Jewish presence in order to provide the capital to keep their economies fluid. But now we have the free loan societies in the United States acting out this biblical idea. And Maimonides also, when he talks about the 8 stages of charity, he says that the highest level of charity is either giving someone what they need anonymously, helping them to start a business, or loaning them money without any interest. Why is loaning just as good as giving someone money? Because loaning preserves the person's self-esteem and integrity. You don't feel like you're taking a handout. Whether or not you are able to pay it back is a different question. Whether or not you do pay it back is a different question. But in terms of the self-esteem that one has, it's a little easier on your ego to accept a loan than it is to accept a handout, to accept a gift. In 1885, the Pittsburgh Platform that we talked about in the last lecture, they included what was already happening in America, the social gospel, as one of the last planks of their Pittsburgh Platform. Rabbi Emil Hirsch of Chicago really was the reform rabbi who was influential in making sure that the social gospel wouldn't be exclusively associated with the Protestants in this country, but should also be something that the Jewish community should get behind. So the last plank of the Pittsburgh Platform reads as follows. In full accordance with the spirit of Mosaic legislation, right? You've got to link it back to us. You can't just say that we're borrowing it from the Protestants. So he wants to link the idea of the social gospel back to the prophets and to the Torah. In full accordance with the spirit of Mosaic legislation, which strives to regulate the relation between rich and poor, we deem it our duty to participate in the great task of modern times to solve on the basis of justice and righteousness the problems presented by the contrasts and evils of the present organization of society. Now, it is indeed true that Reform Judaism was the first significant American denomination, but it was also the first denomination to really promote the idea of social justice. And even till this day, Reform Judaism is ahead of the other denominations in reaching out beyond the Jewish community in doing acts of tikkun olam, what they translate as social justice, whether it's feeding the poor or clothing the naked, much more so than the other denominations. In the late 19th century, some of these Eastern European Jews, they actually formed little societies that were, actually it was usually the women who formed these societies that were specifically dedicated to one of those things. So there was a Malbish Arumim society, clothing the naked, where women would get together and sew clothes for other people in the community that needed some new clothes. So I've got a friend who remembers his grandmother talking about these Malbish Arumim societies, although I think she said it with a slightly different accent than I am saying it. Okay, let's now recap. What we spent the last three lectures talking about are Shimon the Righteous's pillars of what the world stands on: Torah, worship, and deeds of loving kindness. So I mentioned that this might be more than just a kind of literary convention. It really might be the rabbi's understanding that the world would dissolve back into chaos without the study of Torah, without laws, without sacrificial worship. Now, here we need to know a little bit about ancient Near Eastern sacrificial systems. The idea in the ancient Near East was that we sacrifice to God, and then God makes sure that things happen smoothly in this world. Or usually in ancient Near Eastern systems, it's we sacrifice to the gods, in plural, and the gods make sure that we get rain in the appropriate season, and we don't have earthquakes, or the volcanoes don't wipe out cities. That idea was transferred and modified by the Israelites and later on by the rabbis, but there's still this kind of idea that the sacrifices are pleasing to God. And actually, in one passage in Genesis, when Noah offers sacrifices, once he gets off the ark after the flood, it says that God smells the sweet savor of the sacrifices. So we have the sense that God does somehow get something out of the sacrifices, and it sustains the world. But laws and sacrifices aren't enough. You also need these deeds of loving kindness. And whether they're instituted as law, right? Or as the Mishnah says, there's no end, there's no limit to what you can do for someone else. That certainly is the ideal in rabbinic sources, even though the more you do for someone else, it's a zero-sum game, the less time you have to study Torah. So finding that right balance between Torah study and devotion to the community and communal activism and social justice is a tension we see in the rabbis that goes up to this day as well. Okay, we spent the last several sessions looking at central deeds of rabbinic Judaism, right? The most important commandments or ritual activities within Judaism. The next several lectures are going to look at the most important ideas in rabbinic Judaism, concepts, and we'll begin with Messianism.